Hi, I'm Spider Robinson. Welcome to Thrillin' at the Macmillan, a series of 8 essays about space and space travel that I wrote during my term as the first writer-in-residence for the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia, with assistance from the Canada Council for the Arts. These essays were posted over a 9-month period at the Space Center's website, www.hrmacmillanspacecenter.com, and I'll be reading them aloud for you in this podcast series. These essays are podcast under Creative Commons license, with the conditions no derivatives, non-commercial, and share alike. Thrillin' at the Macmillan, number 6. Shootout at the OST Corral, or All You Need is Delta V. Copyright 2006 by Spider Robinson. Ask Elliot Ness. The power of a law, its meaning, depends on who's committed to enforcing it and how far they're prepared to go. In David Milch's HBO series Deadwood, nobody seems prepared to enforce much of anything, and perhaps you've seen the dire consequences of such anarchy. The rights of prostitutes were not respected, men were sometimes cheated, wealth and power and information lay in the hands of a few, undertaking was handled by voracious swine, and foul language was heard in public. Nothing like the shining civilization of laws we enjoy today. So it's understandable that there's very little planetary law. Despite decades of science fiction wishful thinking about Terran federations, no force yet exists that's either A, trusted enough to enforce law equitably by everybody, or B, ruthless enough to crush all those who don't trust it. The best that can be said of the UN is that it makes the European Union look good, but then it makes the old USSR look good. The collapse of that union gave the USA a golden, unprecedented opportunity to become as universally trusted as any state can be. But within a decade or so, the world had somehow acquired the idea. It was a nation of arrogant, belligerent, ignorant, self-righteous, antisocial, greedy, fundamentalist bullies and torturers, or at least allowed itself to be governed by some. It's astonishing, then, given the dearth of global law that means anything, that there's any space law at all. Actually, there's so much of it that a highly condensed summary of the highlights I have before me runs nearly 5 times the length of this essay. There's money involved in space now, serious money with more on the way, so law is needed. But it's cotton candy. Bite into it and there isn't much there. Who enforces what little there is and when and how far they may go in doing so and where the victims, enforcees, can then go for relief are more than a little vague. Which is probably just as well, because there's bitter disagreement on exactly what those few laws mean, if anything. And it's like arguing the Koran. Nobody really has the authority to settle the argument. Here's my précis of an outline of that highly condensed summary of highlights I mentioned, which I got from one of the solar system's leading authorities, Arthur M. Dula, who teaches space law at the University of Houston Law School. He is a founder and CEO of Excalibur Almaz Limited, an Isle of Man-based firm which plans to send manned spacecraft to its own space stations for both tourism and scientific purposes soon. See www.excaliburalmaz.com. He's also executor for the literary estate of Robert A. and Virginia Heinlein, and one of the trustees of the Heinlein Prize Foundation, in which capacities he shares half the rights to and royalties of my latest novel, Variable Star, which I completed from an outline and notes found in Robert's papers. Full disclosure, folks. But I knew and respected Art Dula as the man in space law for decades before we wound up in the fiction business together. Honest, you can ask my wife. Okay, if the whole world were going to get together sometime in the 20th century and do something as quintessentially goofy as dream up a treaty regarding outer space, the entire universe, what decade would you guess it would be offhand? That's right, the 60s. Mere months before Louis Armstrong and Buzz Lightyear took a flying leap for all mankind on the Apollo Creed, or was it the Ocean's 11, and even mirer months after the Beatles sang All You Need Is Love on the first ever global telecast Our World, that is, roughly 40 years ago today, Sergeant Pepper, exactly a majority plus one of the nations on Earth, 97 of 192 countries, agreed to something called the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, or OST. Initials were big then. JFK, LBJ, FBI, CIA. Tragically, the ones that return in ghastly flashbacks every decade or so turned out not to be LSD after all, but KIA and MIA. Unfortunately, less than 3 years later, the Beatles amended their advice. Turned out, all you needed was love, vicious attorneys, and a spouse who said you were the talented one. It just wasn't the same after that. 4 more multinational space treaties came into force in the next dozen years, but just barely, and the last of them was nearly 30 years ago. Each was merely an attempt to elaborate, just enough to make it actually mean anything, one of the vague provisions of the original OST. Each was signed by fewer nations than the one before. The last, the 1979 Moon Treaty, has been ratified by a whopping 12 countries so far, with another 5 still thinking about it real hard, and none of those is a major space power. Specifically, none is the US, the UK, Russia, China, or even Canada. One of the closest to really being a, quote, space power, unquote, would I make this up? You bet, but I swear I didn't, is Kazakhstan, home of famous documentarian Borat Sagdiev. So, basically, these clowns were mice voting that the tigers should all hobble themselves, everybody should get their fair share of green cheese, and Pamela Anderson should make sex on them. High five! As Professor Dula gently puts it, the Moon Treaty is, quote, not generally considered a binding international law, unquote. The one treaty that comes closest to legitimacy, the original OST, only 95 out of 192 nations hated it, said little and defined almost none of its crucial terms, even vaguely, a precedent which was followed faithfully. No space treaty defines outer space, for example, or celestial body, or peaceful purposes, isn't killing troublemakers a peaceful purpose, or even space activities. The OST did opine that outer space, whatever that might be, is, quote, free for exploration and use by all states, unquote, and that this exploration and use, get this, shall be carried out, quote, for the benefit and in the interests of all countries, unquote, and shall be, quote, the province of all mankind, unquote. As I said, it was the 60s. Love was all you need. I think there was only a single issue that anyone who mattered really cared about, and all the rest of the OST was tinsel, unenforceable, wouldn't it be pretty to think so, generalities, solely designed to make it look good to as many nations as possible. The real point was, the U.S. and USSR were neck and neck in their moon race. It really was an even money bet, right up until Armstrong stepped ashore and wished Mr. Gorsky good luck. So each side wanted it stated, loudly and publicly and with as much agreement as could be mustered, that no matter who won the race, no state could lay claim to this new world the way Spain and Portugal had hogged control of the previous new world for all time. The moon, and by extension space itself, was not going to be considered a new world, subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, the way new real estate has been treated since the dawn of time, but something more like an extension of international waters, the common heritage of all mankind, which, as you know, have today been nearly fished out by fewer than a half dozen of those 192 nations. To get the U.S. to agree, the USSR made a major concession for a Marxist country. Nothing in the OST prohibits commercial use or private ownership of space resources. Capitalism is sanctioned. You may not appropriate an area in outer space such as the moon, but anything you can take home is yours. Moon rocks become property the moment they're picked up and can be bought and sold. So Luna may be the common heritage of all men and women, but the helium-3 on its surface will almost certainly end up the sole possession of those few with the capital and foresight to go take it. The same will go for the asteroid belt down the line. That's fine with Russia, which is a capitalist country too now. Not so much with China, the last large nominally Marxist state. In spite of everything the great leader could do, today his people not only have a space program, but a damn good one, with heavy launch capacity even the Russians admire. China has made it clear it's going to space in a big way. It has begun suggesting reconsideration of the OST as obsolete, and more than that, it has already willfully defied the OST's provision against deployment of weapons of mass destruction in space, with its demonstration of a satellite killer missile that could easily bankrupt and starve most of North America in an hour by taking down the network on which its economy utterly depends. Can you think of a peaceful use for such technology? I can't. China has stated its intention to establish a permanent manned base on the moon, ASAP, and can you think of any sensible present use for such a base that is not military? I can't. A few weeks after China's announcement, George W. suddenly remembered to tell us of his own lifelong interest in permanent lunar bases, and even he hasn't thought of any pressing or even sound scientific purposes one might serve yet. Who cares? It's another space race. A chance to recreate the Cold War that was so much fun the last time round. To spend billions erecting enormous phallic towers that fall up instead of down. Two big, dumb empires playing space war with real bombs. One so dumb it has deliberately raised up a whole generation of males with no possible mates and no possibility of homosexual relief. The other so dumb it has raised a whole generation of Chris Moltisanti's, the Sopranos character who, hearing talk of the Cuban Missile Crisis, frowns and says, "I seen that movie. That was real." The basics of space law are going to finally start getting nailed down one way or another sometime in the next 20 to 25 years. If the human race stays as stupid as it's been in the past, the issue will end up being settled the way it usually is in a lawless community like Deadwood. Some individual Roy Bean will tire of all the corpses out in the street, load up a large shotgun, appoint himself judge, and begin enforcing the law, his law, with a thick rope. Who controls space controls the world. Long-term human survival urgently requires exploitation of space resources. Fighting over them could prove fatal for all of us, for our grandchildren. So, who should be the authority that enforces law in space? A nation that can be depended upon to safeguard the common heritage of all mankind every bit as zealously as it now does the cultural heritage and autonomy of Tibet? A nation that will hold the space resources of all nations in trust as faithfully as it now does the oil beneath Iraq or the New Orleans beneath FEMA? Or shall it be the wise, courageous, competent, trustworthy United Nations? Seriously, I'm asking, who would you like to see get the job? Those are the choices. You have 20 years to think about it. Here's a clue to my own opinion. David Gerald's character Solomon Short once wisely said, "Good, fast, cheap. Pick a maximum of two." The solution to this problem has to be fast, and it had better be good. BC writer Spider Robinson's 33rd book, Variable Star, a collaboration with Robert A. Heinlein, is available in hardcover from Tor Books. For further information, visit www.spiderrobinson.com or www.variablestarbook.com. This has been Thrillin' at the Macmillan number 6, the 6th in a series of 8 essays about space and space travel written during my term as first writer-in-residence for the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia, with assistance from the Canada Council for the Arts. Some relevant links can be found at the Space Center's website, www.hrmacmillanspacecenterwithanre.com. Thanks for falling by. I hope you'll come back for the rest of the essays. This is Spider Robinson, still thrilling at the Macmillan. PayPal or Visa donations are most welcome. Just click the link on the podcast page at my website.